So we're starting tonight's Mishmar, which I mistakenly labeled Shir Klali on the handout. Jack Nadell, who Rabbi Branda beautifully introduced just a few minutes ago. And I want to talk through some topics of interest, of importance, share with you some insights. Some may be familiar to you, some I suspect may not. And basically give you a framework for learning the first word of the first pasuk of the Torah. Now you'll see on the whiteboard behind me the title of our shiur, Bereshit, the ultimate halachic question, which itself hopefully should stir a sense of curiosity, because Bereshit is a text which tells us about creation. As Rashi famously says in his first remark a la Torah, Bereshit doesn't contain any laws, at least no explicit laws. In fact, the entire Sefer Bereshit, that's why he says, why did the Torah not begin with the words HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem in Parashat Bo? So I want to already jig you, for you to recognize that we're talking about Bereshit in a different way, because I'm invoking Halacha with reference to Bereshit. But we're not yet there, and we'll get there just in time. We're going to focus just on the first word of the first pasuk, that is the word Bereshit. In general, when I ask to give Divrei Torah Shirim on a parasha, I try and avoid the first verse, because you know often that's the low hanging fruit. That's where a lot of the commentaries say a lot, and really doesn't necessarily show much creativity to say Dvar Torah just on the first verse. But there is so much to be learned from these words, and I think so much that we can apply to our lives today. So let's begin. Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim v'et ha-aretz, which we generally translate as, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. And we know the rabbis debate in response to what people may well say, why does it say Bereshit bara Elokim? Why does it imply that somehow Elokim was created as a further creation? That's not our concern. This verse has been looked at from every facet and every dimension. But the word Bereshit itself is of great interest to our commentaries, to the Midrashim, and specifically to Rashi. And that's going to be our focus of attention for the majority of the shiur. Because I want to bring to your attention Rashi's second remark on his commentary to the Torah. The first is, why does Bereshit basically exist? Why didn't the Torah begin with HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem? And then he says, I think there are lessons to be learned even from this first word. Because Bereshit doesn't necessarily mean in the beginning. It could mean for something called Reshit. Let's have a look at Rashi's remarks here. Ein ha-mikra hazeh omer ele dirshoni. He basically says, this word or these verses are calling out for interpretation. They're beckoning us to take a second look and offer our own explanations to what they mean. And he says, as our rabbis did. And here he gives us a profound opening to the meaning of the word reshit, and therefore the meaning of the word bereshit. Because he says, Bishvila Torah shnikret reshit darko. He tells us of a verse in Mishlei, and this itself is already mentioned in the Midrash Tanchuma Yashan, that the word Reshit is used elsewhere in Tanakh, in the book of Mishlei, to reference Torah. There the Pasuk says, Hashem kanani Reshit darko. God created me at the beginning of his course. And that's understood to refer to Torah. And so Rashi basically says, the word Bereshit could be interpreted to mean for Reshit, meaning for the Torah was the world created. And in so doing, he's given us a really important reflection of the purpose of the world. If Bereshit means for the Torah the world was created, then we've been given a mandate and a mission. That is to live according to the laws of the Torah. Live according to the requirements and expectations of what is Reshit, as elucidated by the verse in Sefer Mishlei. And then Rashi says, there's a different way to read that first word. Because elsewhere in the Tanakh, and Sefer Yirmiyahu, in the book of Jeremiah, we see the word Reshit replied not to Torah, but to the people of Israel. As the Pasuk says, Kodesh Yisrael Hashem Reshit Tvuato. Holy is the Lord our God. We are the first fruits of God's harvest. And that refers to Israel, not the land, but the people. And this leads Rashi to say, "Uvishvil Israel shnikru reshit tvuato," that the world was created for the Jewish people, which are referred to as Israel. And in this second remark of Rashi on the Torah, he's basically telling us the mystery of creation and the meaning of life itself. He says, "Bereshit bara Elokim," in the beginning God created. It's not in beginning, it's for Reshit. What is Reshit? Reshit could mean Torah, or Reshit could mean Am Yisrael, Israel. And thus the world is there for the Torah, or the world was created for the purpose, for the celebration, for the growth, for the meaningful living of Am Yisrael. In the first word of the Torah, we're given the meaning of life. Bereshit. Why do we live? We live for Torah. We live for our people. Now, that's a basic reading of Rashi. If I were to be asked to summarize that, I'd say Rashi's telling us two important but separate statements. The world exists for the Torah, or, slash, and the world exists for the Jewish people. Of course, that's a very particularistic interpretation of the purpose of the world. Both are very Jewish things. You could basically argue from here that the world has no function were there to be no Torah and no Jewish people, which is basically what Rashi is saying. Though we are a minority people, we are the Am HaMa'at. According to Rashi, that Am HaMa'at is the one which brings meaning and purpose, a mission and a teaching, the Dvar Hashem to the world, and consequently we are the Vush of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We are the clothed expression of God and God's will in the world through being the ones who will bestow the Torah. Ad kan, the basics of Rashi. Are there any questions just about what I've said so far? Read a verse, read Rashi, basing himself on basically a couple of Midrashim. Okay. Let me give you a different way of reading this same Rashi. I told you, perhaps a simple way of reading it is the world was created for the Torah and also for the Jewish people. And here I want to quote Rav Aaron Kotler. Who has heard of Rav Aaron Kotler? Okay, who's Rav Aaron Kotler? Well, he's a famous rabbi. Anybody know where he was situated, at least for the majority of his life? Sorry, Lakewood, right? He was a Rosh Yeshiva of Lakewood Yeshiva, yeah? Rav Aaron Kotler, in many ways, is seen to be one of the architects of Orthodoxy in America, one of the people we can really say thank you to for having a Torah world in America. Rav Aaron Kotler, as a Rosh Yeshiva, he has his own view about how to interpret this Rashi. Now imagine you're a Rosh Yeshiva, you're somebody who values Torah a lot, and you're somebody who values Talmidei Chachamim. You may well not necessarily see those two statements of what Reshit means, namely Torah and Yisrael, as being distinct, but he's going to assert that they are totally and utterly related. And I'm going to read just a few words from the longer quote I've given you. Hinei Mevu'ar, and this is from his collected thoughts on the Torah. He says, we learn from this Rashi that the purpose of creation is for one single thing, which is hinted to in this Rashi. And that is that we should be a nation who are receivers of the Torah. We should be a nation who study Torah. We should be a nation of Chachameha, whose sages, Hem Lev Yisrael, are the heart of the Jewish people. And he goes on to therefore explain how I understand this Rashi, and I'm quoting to the penultimate line, Hi Raka Ama Torah. The purpose of the world is in order to enable us as a people, other people who are the carriers of the Torah. V'zeh ma'ash amru chazal, and this is what the rabbi said, b'shvil Yisrael u'b'shvil ha-Torah. in the Rashi that we quoted, Reshit represents how the world was created for Torah and how the world was created for Israel. Hainu sheyu am makablea Torah, that is, we should be a nation or the receivers of Torah, shenibam hem lomdea Torah chachameha, whose heart are the learners of Torah and its sages. Let me explain to you what he does. Have a look at the board here. According to the basic reading of Rashi, Bereshit is for Ishit the world was created, namely for the Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, and for the Torah. Aaron Kotler says these are connected. That is, the Jewish people are only meaningful if Torah is central to their lives. And the gems of the Jewish people are those who value Torah the most. Thus, the purpose of creation is for the Jewish people and for them to celebrate Torah and then to particularly honor those who learn Torah. Do you understand why it makes sense that a Rosh Yeshiva would say such a message? Because what he's kind of saying is, these aren't separate entities. Yisrael is only meaningful with Torah. And Yisrael's relationship with Torah is only meaningful if Yisrael validate and venerate those lomdei Torah v'chachameha. He kind of creates a certain pyramid of importance, which is a world was created for Yisrael, who should learn Torah, and therefore those of Yisrael who learn Torah are at the top of that pyramid. Kapish? So imagine you're one of the Talmidim of Aaron Kotler. You say, aha! If I'm a Talmid Chacham, right? If I'm a Talmid Chachamah, if I learn Torah, right? If I'm somebody who's knowledgeable in Torah, I'm basically a reason for the world to be. I am the Reshit. Yeah? I'm bringing together the Yisrael and the Torah. Ad Kan with Aaron Kotler. Because now I want to give you a different explanation. One from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. You've heard of him, right? Mm-hmm. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he also relates to this Rashi. But he does it in a slightly different way. Rav Aaron Kotler says, the world exists bereshit, because he says that is for the Jewish people to celebrate and learn Torah and therefore to venerate and respect Torah scholars. The Lubavitcher Rebbe says, Zeu klalut inyan shebereshit. Have a look here, this is source 4. This is the meaning and purpose of the word bereshit. Bishvil Yisrael shenitku reshit, bishvil haTorah shenitku reshit. He refers to those words of Rashi. Dahainu, this means, hanhagat Yisrael al pi haTorah. What's the purpose of creation? The Jews should live according to Torah. Jews, basically, should live according to a mitzvah life. Can you see the slight difference between the two? Rav Aaron Kotler interprets the Rashi to say, Bereshit, the world is created for Am Yisrael to learn Torah and to venerate Torah learners. The Lubavitcher Rebbe says, Am Yisrael was created for Torah, to live according to a Torah lifestyle. And you see how they differ? One is about learning, and one is about living. And that kind of makes sense, because those of you who may well have a connection to Chabad, or even if you don't have a personal connection, who may well be aware, of course, of the activities and the shlichut of Chabad, would know that the pinnacle of their pyramid isn't necessarily the Talmud Chacham, it's a person who promotes mitzvah observance and enables others to do so, right? So can you see how in their interpretation you kind of see an expression of the personality of the interpreter, yeah? Rashi says, Bereshit, for Reshit, the world was created, that is, for Torah, for Yisrael. Rav Aaron Kotler brings those together and says, ah, that means for Yisrael to learn Torah and respect Torah scholars. The Baruch Rebbe says, for Yisrael to celebrate Torah and live according to Torah life. Each l'shitato, each reflecting their own worldview. We're going to get to a third view, a really interesting one, of Rabbi Sachs in just a second. But before we do so, through my analysis, I came across a fascinating remark, which is slightly going a little left field, but I think you'll love it. I was unaware of this rabbi, Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Rotenberg, who was a rabbi of Antwerp and a representative of the Jews in Paris in a generation past. But he's quoted by an Israeli scholar called Rav Uri Sharkey. And he says something really, really, really interesting. Listen to this. He says, and I'm going to read, this is Rabbi Sharkey's summary of Rabbi Rotenberg's explanation. Since Rashi says it's right at the beginning of his Torah commentary, he says, "Lachein et hamilim hamikra hazeh," and he makes reference to hamikra hazeh in his comment itself. Yesh lahavin k'musubot al haTanach kulo. We can interpret these words as being, in many ways, an introduction to Rashi's whole entire Torah commentary. You know, some Torah commentaries write an introduction, a hakdama. According to Rabbi Rotenberg, this Rashi is like Rashi's hakdama to his perush on the entire Torah. And he's going to tell us the following. He says, Reshit means Torah, and Reshit means Israel, which means the only legitimate interpreters of this thing called Torah is Israel, the Jewish people, who interpret al-pi ha-Torah, according to the tradition. What Rabbi Rotenberg basically said is, you can read this Rashi to teach us how to learn Torah. Learn Torah, you Jewish people, according to your tradition, which is the Torah Shebaal Peh and the Masorah that we're all familiar with. And thus, he sees this Rashi as a hakdama to his entire perush al ha-Torah. So what we've seen so far is Rashi's remarks on the first word of the Torah, Bereshit, for Reshit. He says, for Am Yisrael, for Torah. We said, what do we do with that? Rav Aaron Kotler says, that teaches us that the whole world is about the Jewish people learning Torah and respecting Torah teachers. We've seen the Baba Chereva saying, the whole world is about the Jewish people keeping the mitzvahs and living a Torah way. And we've seen Rabbi Rotenberg saying, the whole purpose of this Torah is to be interpreted by Israel al-pi ha-Torah. So far, so good? Okay. This is all basically an introduction. Because now we get to, in many ways, the star of this show, which is one of the most remarkable insights I've ever read by any scholar. And I've sometimes quoted Rabbi Sachs, and I'm quite familiar in his writings. And this is an idea he shared many, many years ago in a lecture in England in 1987. I actually have the type notes here. And he said something so majestic that I felt it was worthy to share with you as well. Have a look at source number 6. And he's talking about Jewish law. Some of you in my Jewish thought and Jewish law class know that I'm interested in the dynamic between human interpretation and respecting the laws and wills of God, right? And there's an interesting dynamic, how that's done. I'm interested in psikah, how we generate Jewish laws for complicated and challenging situations. And here Rabbi Sachs says the following. Judaism holds two values to be primary. There is a famous rabbinic commentary on the first word of the Torah, Bereshit. God created the world, said the sages, not in the beginning, but for the beginning. For the sake of two things which are called beginning. For the sake of Torah, which is called Reshit Darko, the beginning of God's way. And for the sake of the Jewish people, which is called Reshit Tvuato, the beginning of God's harvest. And he says, these are supreme agadic values. These are important values in Jewish teachings and Jewish thought. Torah and Israel, Jewish law and the Jewish people. Between them, they constitute the purpose of creation. In Torah, God revealed his will. In the Jewish people, he created, we're just turning the page, he created the witnesses to his presence. That Torah and Am Yisrael are ultimate values and his assertion of Agadah. A world without Torah and a world without Am Yisrael are equally unthinkable. Okay, so if you would pause there, you'd say, that's nice, okay. You haven't really said much different to what we understood from Rashi. That Reshit means Israel, Reshit means Torah. They're both central, key, fundamental, foundational to the world itself. But now comes Rabbi Sachs and says something I think really quite remarkable. He says the supreme halachic task is therefore to mediate between them, which takes precedence in a practical conflict between Jewish law and the Jewish people. That is the ultimate halachic question. Now here, Rabbi Sacks has said something of great interest to us. So far we talked about how we could read Rashi on a basic level, Bishvil Yisrael and Bishvil Torah. We talked about how Rav Aaron Kotler said the Jewish people studying Torah is a meaning of the purpose of the world. And we talked about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Jewish people keeping the Torah, that's a purpose of the world. Comes Rabbi Sacks and he says, you know, life is a little bit more complicated than that. Sometimes there's a conflict between the people and the law. Sometimes there's a tension between the needs of Israel and the demands of Torah. And that question is the ultimate halachic question. And since I read this many, many years ago, I've come back at it time and again. I quoted it in Jewish thought and Jewish law class. And I believe it to be such a profound expression of every shaila you'll ever hear, ever. Because every shaila, every halachic consideration is a balance of Yisrael and Torah. I'll give you one example just from the class we just had. We were talking about the laws of Shemitah. You know the laws of Shemitah where you're supposed to leave a field, right? You're not supposed to farm or harvest in that field every 7 years. That's Torah. It says it there in Vayikra chapter 25. The problem is that there have been times when that's really difficult to keep. Impossible. In the late 19th century, Jews had no food, had no way of bringing in food. And by keeping Shemitah, people would die. People would starve. Here you have a conflict between the Torah, the law of Shemitah, and Israel, the needs of the people. The ultimate halachic question is, how do you mediate between the two? You can't simply say Shemitah is not important. It's Torah. You can't say the people are not important. They die. How do you figure out a way to be true to Torah and fulfill the needs and respect the needs of Israel? That's the ultimate halachic question. And we can think of more. We can think of more examples of how there are different needs. Somebody was recently talking about kashrut, yeah? The laws of kashrut, I mean, I suppose there's even a hint to it in Parsha Bereshit itself. We can have a high standard of kashrut, which really represents the ultimate demands of Torah, but that may well not meet the needs of the majority of the Jewish people. Or we can have a kashrut standard that speaks to the majority of the Jewish people, may well be a compromise of Torah. The supreme halachic question is, how do you find the balance between the reshit, namely Torah, and the reshit, namely Israel? And if you think about every major halachic consideration and question and debate, you'll be able to frame it within this model that Rabbi Sacks has described. But the reason why it becomes particularly important today is in light of changes that happened basically about 200 years ago. And here I refer to just a brief paragraph from Rabbi Sacks' excellent book called One People, where he talks about developments in the Jewish world and different denominations and how we maintain unity in a world where there's so many different factions and different directions of our people. And he said, Rav Sadia Gaon, you've heard of Rav Sadia Gaon, right? Rav Sadia Gaon predicated the oneness of Israel as a nation on halacha. He basically said, the central feature of Am Yisrael is Torah. Rav Sadia Gaon basically always said, Reshit means Israel and Torah. You can't divide them. The Jewish people are the Torah nation. Torah is for the Jewish people. And as Rabbi Sacks says, Jews are people bound together and constituted as such by their shared acceptance of Jewish law. For at least 1,800 years, from the destruction of the Second Temple to European emancipation, Jewish unity was conceived in religious terms. But today, such an interpretation seems unavailable, meaning the majority of the Jewish people do not keep the majority of Torah. We're aware of this, right? Yeah. Yeah. Meaning until relatively recently in our history, Yisrael and Torah were intimately bonded. Reshit of Torah and Reshit of Israel were together. A Jew was somebody who prayed, who kept kosher, who kept Shabbat. And then for reasons of historical development, scientific development, and shifts in the Jewish world and the wider world. Not every Jew was keeping Shabbat. Not every Jew was keeping kosher. Yisrael started to dilute its relationship with Torah. Then, you know, most of us have perhaps non-Shabbat observing relatives. 300 years ago, no Jew would be able to have that. That didn't exist. Yisrael was a twin, bonded absolute with Torah. Today it's no longer. And this is why Rabbi Sacks says what he says. The supreme halachic question is, how do we find a balance? Now, we could talk of many examples, and in his original lecture in 1987, he gives a number of them, and this is a transcript from it. But I want to reference, one particular case. We'll talk about it for about 10 minutes, and then we're going to end, okay? I want to talk about one really important question, which I don't think is discussed enough within Orthodoxy. And I want to make reference to a great article on the subject written by Rabbi Mark Drach, which can be found in this very long-winded titled book called The Relationship of Orthodox Jews with Believing Jews of Other Religious Ideologies and Non-Believing Jews. It's a weird title, but it's a fascinating book. And here, there are many essays, of which one is as follows. He asks, how does the Orthodox Jewish community relate to intermarried Jews, their non-Jewish spouses, and their children? You see, we have an issue today. I don't know if you're aware that in North America, if you don't count the Orthodox community, intermarriage is at about 73-75%.
The Jewish community?
Basically, amongst non-Orthodoxy, intermarriage is about 73-75%. If you count Orthodoxy, it's in the late 50s.
Wait, that's this is non-Orthodox Judaism.
Correct.
Not like the whole world population without Orthodoxy.
Correct, but if you take all of Jews in America, intermarriage is about 57%, unless I'm wrong. Uh-huh. I'm happy to be correct on the stats, but it's in that ballpark, okay?
So you take Orthodox Jews out and it's like 75?
Yeah. So the question is this. In the olden days, we took a very strong view against intermarriage. We basically said, do not intermarry, and if you do, I'll sit shiver for you. Have you ever seen movies where they talk that through, or in literature, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you've probably seen the jazz singer, yeah?
Yeah.
Whatever. But here's a challenge. In a world where Yisrael and Torah were bonded together, we could stand for Torah in order to nudge Yisrael along the right path. But now that much of Israel are not necessarily so loyal to much of Torah, the question is, what do we do with those Jews? Let's frame it differently. You meet a Jew who's married out, yeah? You can say, well, they're doing something wrong. But if you don't include them, well, then you're excluding them. You're sacrificing Israel for your interpretation of Torah. If you overly include them, if you could call such a thing, they're sacrificing Torah for Israel. By the way, to use a different word, maybe we perhaps prefer to use the term peoplehood. Have you ever heard that phrase before? No. How do we balance Jewish law or Jewish values with Jewish peoplehood? We like to use that word a lot in studies and discussions. But how do we balance the needs of Jewish peoplehood when much of our Jewish people isn't connected to Jewish law? And for Rabbi Sacks, in his interpretation of this Rashi, the ultimate halachic question is, how do we mediate the Israel and the Torah, the peoplehood and the laws? How do we find room for people who haven't found their place in Orthodoxy? Because if we don't, they're never going to find their place in the people that are going to feel rejected and walk their way. How important is it to make compromises for in halakha to include those who are less observant? And when we do make compromise in halakha, how much damage do we do to the halachic system itself? These are kind of big questions which I like exploring, and those of you who attend one of my classes, you know that this is what we talk about on a regular basis. And Mark Dratch, in this essay, talks about them really eloquently. He's very direct, and I want to just read one or two things and I'll take your quotes, right? He says the following: the goals of the Orthodox community are many, but in this context they include the safeguarding Rabbi Soloveitchik's covenant of destiny and covenant of faith. If you're not sure what that means, read Kol Dodi Dofek. The survival of the Jewish people and the fulfillment of Torah and Mitzvot. Intermarriage poses serious threat to both, and by asking these questions we are in no way advocating intermarriage or seeking to make it more acceptable. Our challenge is how to best assure endogamy, right? And he then goes on to say the following. You know, this isn't the first time we're having to consider how do we deal with people who break major rules in Judaism. About 200 years ago, we saw the Dren, sorry?
Skila Srifa.
That may be right. So guess what? You get Skila for breaking Shabbos. And then 200 years ago, we saw a great trend, a great development of people who are breaking Shabbat in the Jewish people. Now, we could have said, you're out of here. Anyone who breaks Shabbos isn't Jewish. Any breaks Shabbos isn't welcome. They're not welcome in our shuls. They're not welcome to get any honors. We basically didn't do that. Most of us in most of our communities, we kind of said, we know what Shabbos is. But people who's important enough for us to still care about Shabbat, but still care about the people who don't care enough about Shabbat, to want them to stay included. And what we did is we kind of created, and it's based particularly on a ruling of Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, we kind of found a golden mean to be true to Shabbat, but also true to those Jews who don't know enough about Shabbat. What Rabbi Mark Dratch is asking here is, maybe the time has come to do that same thing with reference to Jews who have intermarried. He's not supportive, but he's saying, where do we stand in terms of that continuum with Torah on one end and Israel on the other? What are our duties for peoplehood, for the sake of Torah? And what are our duties of Torah, notwithstanding the fact that it could alienate some people of our nation? Any quick thoughts? We're going to wrap up in a few minutes. Quick thoughts about where we're at? Okay. I want you to have a look at page 3. And here I'm going to quote somebody whose name you're probably familiar with. I presume you've heard of Rav Schechter of YU. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so some of you maybe, some may not. Rav Herschel Schechter, not only a primary student of Rav Soloveitchik, but Rosh Hashiva of Yeshiva University and the leading halachic consultants at OU himself. And what does he say? Many advocate a harsh attitude. This is towards intermarriage, okay? Rabbi Herschel Schechter goes so far as to argue that while one who is intermarried retains Kedushat Yisrael, the sanctity of Jewishness, that person is not part of Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people. He stipulates that membership of Klal Yisrael includes 4 prerequisites: belief in the wonders of God, the fulfillment of the mitzvah of circumcision, not marrying a non-Jew, and belief that God gave the land of Israel to the Jewish people. And these requirements would exclude large parts of the Jewish people, even many who are married to Jews, from membership in Klal Yisrael. Basically, what Rav Schechter kind of said is, I got to stand up for Torah and basically tell people who are doing things sufficiently bad in my eyes or my interpretation of the halacha's eyes, that they're not part of Yisrael. If you're into marriage, you've walked away. And our job is to make it clear that you're not part of the close-knit family, which is Klal Yisrael. And he would argue that's necessary in the defense and the honor of Torah. Others would obviously take a different view and say, how is that going to help anything? But you can see that there are no winners and losers in these debates. You stand up for Torah, you alienate Jews. You stand up for Jews, you can dismiss the needs of Torah. I think I might have mentioned before the Midrash that compares 3 great teachers in the Tanakh: Eliyahu, Yonah, and Yirmiyahu. Eliyahu stood up for Torah, but alienated himself from the people. Yonah stood up for the people, but alienated himself from God. And Yirmiyahu apparently found the golden mean, the Shvila Zahav. He stood up for the laws of the Torah and the values of the Torah, and yet he also stood up for the needs and the challenges of the Jewish people. The question is, who can be our Yirmiyahu today? Or where is the wisdom of Yirmiyahu in terms of these kind of complex questions of intermarriage, for example, today? What should be the right response of an Orthodox Jew when they meet people who are strayed? If you turn a blind eye against their religious infractions, how can you call yourself Orthodox? If you turn your head and your neck from that Jew, how can you call them part of Klal Yisrael? Any quick thoughts before we wrap up? Let's read the final paragraphs of Rabbi Drach. It says, I'm just reading from the bottom of page 3. Many Orthodox synagogues today try to find ways to achieve a balance in their responses to intermarriage. Rabbis preach against it, schools teach that it is prohibited, and parents reinforce this message to their children. At the same time, it's the last page, babies of Jewish mothers are circumcised and named in synagogues, although often no official announcements are made congratulating the family. You may have been in shuls like that. They'll do a bris for a child from an intermarriage, but they won't make a big announcement, and that can offend people. But this is a shul trying to figure out being that Jeremiah in our complex day and age. Jewish children are often welcomed into many schools, regardless of observance or parentage. Efforts to bring the family closer to Jewish observance and conversion are common in many communities, although the halakhic parameters of such conversions are the subject of heated debate. The challenges of intermarriage and assimilation are great. The consequences of failing to address them properly and effectively are devastating. The methods of dealing with them are not perfect. Each has its benefits and its risks. Whichever path we choose, lo tuchal litalem. We cannot ignore our responsibility to our God, His Torah, and our people. So I want to conclude by referring back to that same Rashi, the second Rashi ala Torah. Make us realize there is so much we can learn just from a few short words. Let's read it again. Bereshit bara, ein mikra ze omer ela dirshu nikmo shedirshu rabotein chazav. בשביל התורה שנקראת ראשית דרכו, בשביל ישראל שנקראו ראשית תבואתו. The question is how to even read the Rashi. Are these two separate entities, Yisrael and Torah? Are they intertwined where we put at the top of that pyramid, the Talmud Chacham and the Talmud HaChachamah? Are they related like the Baruch Rebbe says, that at the top of that pyramid is actually the person who drives Yisrael to keep Torah and to live according to mitzvahs? Is this a mission statement of Rashi, how to interpret the Torah itself? Or, as Rabbi Sachs tells us, is this really almost a formula to try and figure out how to answer the toughest of Jewish questions? How to figure out and how to answer the ultimate halachic questions when there's tensions and conflict between Torah and Israel? I think there's a lot of wisdom to be learned from this Rashi. A lot of wisdom to be learned from this insight of Rabbi Sachs. More significantly, I think, as young, influential, leading, modern Jewish thinkers and teachers that you are, it's worthwhile bearing in mind what Rabbi Drach is saying, which is, we have an issue. We have a problem. The Jewish people's loyalty to Torah is waning in certain parts of the world. That's a reality. We could obviously need to teach them, like the Baruch Rebbe would say. We just need to promote Torah learning, like Rav Kotler says. Still, do we say, you're not part of Klal Yisrael? Or do we stand up for Torah? Do we stand up for peoplehood and not stand up for Torah? How are we going to lead the Jewish people as we confront these challenges in our day and age, in our generation, and those that come? That's your homework from now. You can discuss over Shabbat in the coming weeks. So I wish you well. Shabbat Shalom. Take care.